time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for December 26th, 2020. Happy Boxing Day! Happy Holidays! And I hope you are finding some time to relax. We've got almost 2 feet of snow here in Northeast Ohio, and it's been just fine with me to take my time and put together what I think is a pretty good show. I want to start with asking if you have lived the life you want, following your dreams and finding the path that is satisfying and that feels right. My first guest, Jamie Anderson, realized more than 20 years into a successful career with a wife he loved and 3 great kids that his childhood dream hadn't been fulfilled, and that it hadn't diminished, either. His idol as a child was Greg LeMond, and his circumstances pointed him away from a career as a professional cyclist and into one of academics and consulting. Our conversation is about what happened that led him to that path not taken earlier in life and the message it offers all of us. After a break, we'll talk with Sean Wilson out in Redlands, California. You might remember that we spoke with Rob DeMartini, CEO of USA Cycling, last week about the new Olympic Development Academy. This program is offered to those who are 16 and older. But what about youngsters, those who are just starting to ride through the age where the ODA might be a place to move a talented rider towards the Olympic dream? Sean Wilson has a lot of the answers to this question. He's the founder and head coach at Youth Cycling Association in Redlands, California. Coming from a racing background through an extensive and storied academic career, he's able to take his science into his coaching and training to get kids safely and more skillfully riding on 2 wheels. So first, it's a great discussion with the stand-up strategist, Jamie Anderson. Hello, Jamie Anderson. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, and thank you so much for joining me. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Thanks, Diane. Great to be here, and thanks for the introduction. I'm really excited to be speaking with you.
You have quite the illustrious background and career, and you're such an interesting person. I thought you would be a fun guest for the show, and I think the story that you have to tell is going to resonate with a lot of my listeners. We are, many of us are over 50, and you're getting there. You're not there yet. And you made such a huge change in your life. So let's go back to your early days in Australia and tell me about your first big dream, because I got a kick out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, Dan, I grew up really in the bush in Australia, in a little country town called Shepparton, which was in country Victoria. So that's the southeast corner of Australia. So, you know, I wasn't the surfy kind of kid because we were about 200 miles from the coast. But I grew up in this little rural community, but it was an amazing place because we had a really incredible, enthusiastic cycling club and a cycling culture in this little town. So I actually started out, I guess, 9 or 10 years old on the BMX track, and then I went on to the track because, believe it or not, in this little town of 17,000 people, the cycling club had built an Olympic standard velodrome. So
wow.
I was riding on the track by the time I was like 13, 14 years old. And then it was really incredible because from that little town, we had Olympians, we had world champions. So by the time I was 15 or 16, I was pretty much training and racing alongside many of those men and women. And that's really where my dream to turn professional kind of evolved.
And you had a hero who, by the way, was just awarded the Congressional Gold Medal here in the U.S.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, as a kid growing up in the 80s, of course, Greg LeMond was like a real idol for me. So, you know, my bedroom was kind of like a, yeah, it was like a shrine to cycling. And of course, Le Monde was one of the guys who I looked up to. Yeah, so that was really my dream as a teenager, was to move to Europe and turn professional and try to make it.
And that did not happen.
No, well, you know, Dan, it's sometimes life doesn't evolve the way you would hope it does. And you know, the reality was that, you know, I came from a pretty big family. I had six brothers and sisters. And it was pretty tough to make ends meet when we were kids. And I was kind of lucky because I was one of the younger ones. And in fact, by the time I was sort of in my early teens and racing my bike, you know, most of my older brothers and sisters moved out of home. But actually, when I reached, I guess I was 15 or 16, my dad went through a real rough period. Yeah, he was a good man, but he was complicated. You know, he always had problems with alcohol throughout his life. And then later on in his kind of, I guess it was then his mid-50s, he developed mental illness, and that really evolved into full-blown bipolar disorder. And he ended up in institutions and stuff. So, you know, that made things really tough for me as an athlete, you know, trying to balance having a sick dad and looking after my mum, my younger brother, and at the same time, you know, trying to finish high school as well. So cycling started to suffer at that time.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Jamie Anderson, and there's a sort of a moniker that they give him, the stand-up strategist. But really what I see him as is somebody who realized a dream that he had to let go for a really long time. You did decide to abandon cycling. You did go to university, and you had an incredibly successful career. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Dan, you know, I finished high school, and of course, my dream had been to go off and, you know, become professional as a cyclist. But with the situation that I had at home, with my dad's illness in particular, that was becoming really, really tough. I mean, even when I was 17, 18, just to have the money to get to races and to buy stuff, you know, cycling equipment stuff, was getting really tough. And then I did my end of year exams in high school, and I actually did really, really well. And because of that, I was offered the opportunity to go to university. I was offered a scholarship as, you know, a kid from a low income family. So, you know, I never forget kind of lying in my bed one evening, just thinking about that choice, you know, of what am I going to do? Because, of course, university was a massive opportunity because of my six brothers and sisters, I was the only one to finish high school. And then to have this offer to go to uni was pretty huge. But, of course, it wasn't really what I wanted to do because my dream had been as a cyclist. But given the way things were panning out, I decided to take up the scholarship and go to uni. So, you know, the thing about that, and I reflect upon this, I guess, later in life, is that as an athlete, as a young athlete, and particularly someone who has competed at the highest level, you know, I competed at state and national level, even as a kid, you have a special kind of drive, a special kind of discipline, a work ethic, a competitiveness, an ability to set goals for yourself. And basically, you know, once I decided that my path was going to be an academic one, I took that same work ethic and drive into my studies and then into my career. And that, I think, was a big part of why I was able to thrive. Yeah.
You sort of followed that career for 20 years, a little more than that. You got married, you've got children. And what struck you and when that suddenly life was not exactly, even though it was very successful, it wasn't really what you wanted? What happened?
Yeah, you know, Dan, I think that's an interesting one, right? Because, you know, when I got to university, I went to the University of Melbourne, which is a really prestigious, you know, college in Australia. And when I got there, I was not like the other kids. You know, most of the other kids at that university were from private schools and privileged backgrounds. And, you know, I was this kind of working class kid for the bush, and a lot of them looked down on me. So, you know, I really had this drive to be better than them. You know, I hated those kids. I thought they were just spoiled, you know, lucky brats. And so initially, that was the drive, you know, I wanted to be better than other people. You know, I guess that was my competitiveness as a sports person, but also, you know, I really did want to make my parents proud. My dad actually, he passed away when I was 21, but, you know, I had my mum there, I had my brothers and sisters, and they all did an immense, you know, amount to also get me through university to help me. So, you know, I really wanted to prove to them and to give back to them the support that they'd given me. So, you know, that kind of really drove me. And then, you know, I did get into this academic world. I eventually found myself into, you know, the top echelons of the business school world as a strategy professor. And I have to say, you know, during my 20s and 30s, I kind of got a kick out of it, right? Because it was about being recognized, being rewarded, being promoted. But I have to say, you know, I mean, I was good at writing case studies and doing research and publishing articles and stuff, but, you know, strategy wasn't exactly my passion. It wasn't really my, I don't know how to put it, but yeah, I was good at it, but I didn't really get a lot of enjoyment out of doing the work that I was doing. But of course, other people looking at me from the outside were thinking, you know, what an amazing, successful person he is and how he's being recognized and promoted and everything like that. But I just started to feel a bit hollow about that because it wasn't giving me fulfillment as a person.
So I watched this TED Talk, which we will let people know how to watch when we're, you know, towards the end of our conversation, because it's really fascinating. And I think it will give a lot of people incentive, regardless of their age, regardless of what they're doing in their lives right now, pause to say, am I really doing what I want to do? And certainly this has been a year, 2020, to reflect upon that. So you and your wife sat down and you actually started with a blank sheet of paper, except there was a little bicycle in the corner that you drew.
That's so right.
I think it's a great story.
Yeah. You know, Dan, I think this is also something which was a real catalyst for me, right? Because, you know, I had been a high achiever through my 20s and my 30s. But, you know, along that journey of being a high achiever, you know, everyone's telling you it's about you. You know, it's about your success and your talents and your opportunities. And no one along that path, you know, certainly when I was at university, when I did my MBA, when I went into my graduate studies, you know, nobody sort of told me that there would come a point in time when it's not just about you, it's about the we, you know, it's about your wife and your children and every, and that. And, you know, what I started to realize actually was that the success that I was having in my career, and here, you know, I wasn't just teaching at business school. I also set up my own consultancy business. I was traveling the world, that it was really coming at a cost. And that cost was at the cost of my relationship with my wife, you know, I wasn't being the dad that I would have hoped I could be for my kids. And it was also taking a personal tax on me physically and emotionally. You know, I wouldn't say I was burned out, but I think if I had continued on the way I was continuing, then that would have been a real risk. So, you know, I started to realize this, and then certainly my wife was realizing it. So we sat down together, and what we did was talk about how we would view success as a family, not just in the context of my career. And Diane, honestly, I mean, that was the best thing that I think we could have done, because what I realized was that my wife had made certain assumptions about my ambition. You know, she thought that once I made it to a certain level of income and you know, reputation and stuff, that I would slow down, which I wasn't doing. And I don't know what my assumptions were, but, you know, my assumption was just that, look, you know, I haven't reached the top yet and I have to keep going. I just still had this drive. But I also started to lose the sight of where was I going, you know? So that's how that process started. And what we did is we sat down, we took a sheet of paper, and essentially we reflected upon four aspects of our life. And the first aspect, of course, was the relationships. And what we started to realize, of course, that as a couple, we'd lost romance. You know, we were deeply in love and we really admired each other, but we weren't spending time with each other. We weren't spending, you know, really romantic quality time as a couple. And as I said, because of my travel and being away from home so much, I was really not being a good dad with my kids. You know, and I remember reading bedtime stories to my kids at that time and constantly having other things on my mind, you know, trying to rush through the stories because I had to answer emails or write a report or something like that. So we wanted to fix that. The second thing was about, you know, where did we actually want to live? Because we'd essentially been moving cities because of my career, and we were living in, you know, loft apartments, inner city, you know, nice neighborhoods. But they certainly weren't the kind of neighborhoods where our kids could run and be free like, you know, I did and my wife did as a kid growing up in rural areas. So we thought, you know, we don't want our kids to grow up in big cities and privileged kind of areas and places where we have to, you know, hold their hand every time they walk down the street. And part of that was also about wanting to travel with the kids and see the world because, you know, because of my intense work, we had very short vacations. So those were the first two aspects we talked about. And then the third thing was that I guess I started to realize that there was this massive kind of hole I had in my life, which was the unfinished business of the dream that I had as a cyclist. And even as I say it now, I start getting a little bit emotional about it because, you know, I really started to realize how much loss I still felt about that, about not realizing my potential. And I told my wife about it, and she was amazed because, you know, she'd only known me as this kind of career guy and professional and academic. She never realized that I'd been an elite sports person because I'd never really shared that with her. And when I told her about this dream, she was incredibly supportive, and she said, well, you have to go for it. You have to see what you can do. And, you know, Diane, when we talked through those three things, you know, of course, what I started to realize was that the career that I had at that moment was simply incompatible with achieving those three things. So that's where I also decided to take a big step and actually step away from my career path that I was on. Yeah.
So we're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we're going to find out what Jamie did. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have BikeLaw as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to BikeLaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you're not just joining me because the whole conversation needs to be in context. Right before our break, we were talking about Jamie sitting down with his wife and figuring out there was a big hole in his heart, and it's called a bicycle. And of course, that's where we're going to pick this up. Tell us about what you actually did at that point. Did you quit your job? Did you move? Did you do all the things you wanted to do and then pursue the biking?
Well, I mean, here's the thing, you know, of course, you know, again, I explained a little bit about my childhood, you know, it was not exactly stable or predictable in terms of
right
the financial side of things. So of course, you know, there was anxiety on my behalf there. So, you know, the first thing I did was step back. And again, I spoke to my wife about this and I realized, you know what, Dan, you know, I'd been working for 20 years, 15 years. And, you know, we'd done pretty well and we had some, you know, money and some investments behind us. We didn't have big debt burden or anything like that. So, you know, I sort of did the calculations and the numbers and said, you know what, you know, I think we could definitely afford for half a year or a year where I could step back from the grind of work and travel just to think about stuff, you know, and again, to spend time with my kids. My kids at that time were 6 years old, 4 years old and 2 years old. But certainly for me, that little kind of budget calculation was important. Initially what I did was I went into the business school where I was working and I tried to propose kind of a part-time, you know, shift to part-time and step away from a lot of the responsibilities I had and just do some teaching and, you know, still write, but more sort of practitioner oriented writing as opposed to the real hard academic stuff. But they were not too flexible on that. So what I actually did then was to look out for some other institutions, and particularly in the area of executive education, where I could work on a part-time basis. And I managed to open a few doors there. So I had a little bit of security in terms of a little bit of income that I could rely on. But actually, in hindsight, I wouldn't have even needed to have done that because we did have enough kind of in the bank to tide us over for that half year or year or so. But so then we actually moved back to Belgium, which is where my wife is from. We were living at Before that, we'd been living in London and in Berlin. We moved back to Belgium. And what we actually did was readjust our living expenses. So, you know, we really took a step down in terms of, you know, the cost of living. We rented a relatively cheap, you know, apartment just outside of Brussels. We bought a secondhand car. And even with our vacations and stuff, it was camping, you know, in France with the kids, but on a lower budget. And that was also a bit of a revelation for me, Dan, because actually, I guess I'd never kind of asked along the path of this career I was on, particularly because I'd been in this kind of high-flying world of the business school. I never really reflected on how much money was enough. And suddenly in that sort of first 3 to 6 month period, I started realizing, you know what, we don't need much money to have a good life, you know, if we adjust certain things. So that was kind of a big revelation for me. And then, of course, you know, alongside that realization that, you know, we were okay financially for a while, was just getting back on my bike. And I started to ride a lot. And that was also an amazing experience, because suddenly when I was out on my bike and releasing all this pressure of the responsibility and the commitments and the work and all that stuff, I suddenly had time to think about, you know, what actually are my talents, you know, like what am I good at, and actually what do I enjoy doing? And of course, a big part of that was riding my bike again. But then I also started to realize there was other avenues for me professionally as well.
You decided that you were going to pursue the original dream and actually compete at that highest level as masters.
Yep.
So
exactly.
let me ask you a question, which I didn't ask you in our pre, you know, question. You know, everybody knows I send questions to my guests. So what kind of bike were you training and racing on at that time?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, I bought a nice bike. I think I bought a Pinarello, which of course was one of my dreams. as a teenager, I bought a Pinarello Prince, and it was lovely to be out riding. And it was just amazing to get back into that as well, you know, like all the technology, the equipment and all that stuff. But also, you know, you have to realize I've been off my bike for pretty much 20 years. You know, I'd ridden to work and played around on a bike. It took time. But actually the biggest, I guess, revelation for me, Diane, was I saw in 2010 when I was making this transition, it was actually in 2009, I was watching TV and on TV on Eurosport came the World Masters Games, which at that year were taking place in Sydney. And I couldn't believe it. You know, like I didn't realize that there was this whole elite masters level of sport. And the World Masters Games, it's like an Olympics for old people, you know? I mean, it's 23 different sports and everything. And I was watching TV and on came the cycling road race. And I thought, wow, you know, because I knew I was too old to turn professional at almost 40, of course. So then I started doing my homework. And then I realized actually there's this whole world of elite, you know, master cycling on the road, on the track. So actually the goal I set for myself was to get to the next World Masters Games, which were going to be in Torino in Italy in 2013. And I was going to be on the podium. That was my goal. And that's basically what I started working towards from early 2010. I got my bike, started riding. But gosh, I tell you, it was an uphill journey, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Well, it's interesting you say for old people. I guess we'd have to define old. I know Masters is usually 35 and up. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. In cycling, it's 35 and up, because 35 is when of the age by which many people retire from professional cycling. And then you have your 5-year age group classifications. So that was it. But, you know, because we'd moved back to Belgium, and not only had I sent myself this goal to make it to the World Masters, you know, we were now living in what is basically the epicenter of world cycling.
Yeah, no kidding.
And you know, the level here, Diane, the level of masters racing here in Belgium is absolutely world class. You know, if you can win any kind of amateur event here, even masters level in Belgium, it's world level. So that was a big shock for me, big shock for the first couple of years, you know, adjusting to that.
Yeah. So people are sitting here with bated breath. What happened? So take us to the Masters in 2013 in Torino.
Yeah, so that was amazing. So I, first 2 years of training, and it was really hard. You know, I was getting dropped in basically every race I was doing in Belgium. I went off to some international races, getting absolutely hammered. But then by 2012, I was starting to get some results here in Belgium, and I started, I guess, to believe. And so I qualified, and I went off to the World Masters in Torino. I did two races there. I did the Criterium and the road race. The Criterium is the short circuit race, the street race.
Right.
And I was feeling great. I was in a group of five guys. We were away. And then I punctured just three laps from the finish, which was quite heartbreaking. But in hindsight, it was also a little bit of an advantage, because I didn't get a result in the Criterium. So the best guys who were there, I wasn't really on their radar screen. You know, they hadn't seen me at the finish and so on. So I then went into the road race. And I think we started with about 160 guys. And that was just amazing. We were racing in the center of Turin. In Italy, and we had a circuit. It was about an 8-kilometer circuit, and I think we did something like nine or ten laps of the circuit. And it was just intense, because you know, in that group of riders, they were former professionals, really world level guys. And I'd been basically training for that race for 4 years. I'd studied the course, I'd prepared myself exactly for the profile, which suited me a lot because basically it was a lap, every lap we went over a climb, which was called Mount Cappuccini, which is a very steep climb up to a monastery of about a kilometer long. And that suited me, my physiology, actually perfectly because I'm a light, punchy rider. So that course suited me. So, you know, we started the race and then, of course, it was just a race of attrition because every time we went over the climb, you know, I'd look behind me and there were 20 guys more gone and there were 20 more guys gone. And then coming into the final two laps, there was maybe 15 or 20 of us left. And at that stage, you know, I really started to believe that something could happen. Yeah, it was quite a feeling. And then, of course, you know, beside the road with my wife and my three beautiful kids, and they were waving the Australian flags and they were cheering. And it was really, really remarkable. Yeah. So in the end, we're coming into the finish. We had about a kilometer to go. There was a Czech rider, former professional. He went up the road. He attacked and everyone paused. So he was away. And then there was a group of us, I guess a group of about 10. And I saw that there were two or three Italians in the group and understanding team tactics, I saw that they were going to do a lead out for one of their guys. So I basically jumped onto the Italian sprint train. It was a bit chaotic towards the finish. But I followed that train and then I jumped and I came in second across the line in the chase group. So I came home with a bronze medal, which was just for me amazing. Yeah, really, really was. Yeah.
I think it would be amazing for anybody. This will be probably our last reintroduction, but once again, we've been listening to Jamie Anderson's story of coming full circle, I guess, from where you started to standing on the podium, which was your childhood dream. I can't imagine anybody listening to this saying, wow, I wish I could have done that. And I think that they can because pretty much that's what you do now. You help people shape their dreams into reality.
Yeah, Dan, you know, of course it was an incredible emotional experience, you know, being there in Torino. And even when I talk about it now, I still feel the emotions coming because, well, I guess what I realized, and in fact, I even realized it before the start of the race. And there's a beautiful photo that my wife took, and I'm on the start line in Torino, you know, we're surrounded by these 160 guys, you know, there's people there next to me from Lithuania, from Latvia, from Ukraine, from Italy, from Spain. And my little girl, Hannah, comes up to me, and at the time she was about 9 years old, and, you know, she took me by the hand. She kind of wiggled through the marshals and came into the rider pen, and I never forget what she said because, you know, here's my little girl, and, of course, she's hoping for me to get a result. But she actually held my hand, and she said to me, "Papa, it's okay if you don't win," you know. And for me that was just a mind-blowing sort of moment because what I realized actually was that, of course, I had a goal and a dream to win in Torino, but more than that, just being on the start line was just such a massive, massive win for me, you know. And I think had become a win for my family because, you know, when my little girl held my hand and she told me, she said what she said, you know, I actually realized at that moment that everything that my wife and I had drawn in that picture almost 4 years before in terms of what we would see as a good life had fallen into place, you know. And I wasn't a professor anymore and I wasn't some high-flying consultant, but actually I kind of found a new professional path with keynote speaking. I'd given a few TED Talks and that was all going pretty well, you know. The bills were being paid. We were earning enough to take the kids away on holidays and all that stuff. But more than that, you know, I had a wonderful relationship with my wife. I had just an awesome relationship with my children that I have to this day. And I was an athlete again. So, you know, the bronze medal was an absolute bonus, but the bronze medal really wasn't what it was about. It was the whole journey kind of to get there. Does that make sense, Diane?
Absolutely. It's win, win, win. So, yes, absolutely. So what are you doing now? So now it's a few years later. I assume you are still riding your bike.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I love to ride my bike. But that was actually the other, I guess, realization that came to me. And I think it came to me a few months after Torino. You know, I started to realize that, you know, I'd been on this journey and ultimately what it had been was a journey towards happiness, right? Because if you see photos of me from 2009, 2010, I was just miserable. I was miserable in every sense of the word. And you know, what we'd done in this 4 years had been a massive shift in terms of just trying to bring more joy into our lives and more balance and more happiness. And like I said, we still pay the bills and make money and stuff. But to put happiness or to define success in a much broader way than the bank balance, you know. And then what I started to realize was, of course, I'd been in this business school world for almost 20 years. And, you know, I started to realize that the experience that I'd been through was absolutely not unique, because in my role as an educator, an educator of executives, you know, I saw people who looked just like I did, you know, 5 years ago every single day, because I was still teaching in business schools. I was still speaking at conferences and events. So that actually inspired me to try to share my story with others. And that eventually led to me getting onto the TED stage in 2015, where I shared my story with people and what I'd been through. And the reaction to that was really, really amazing, because I suddenly had people reaching out to me asking for advice, you know, asking for more explanation of how I'd done it and what I'd struggled with and all that stuff. So that also then resulted in a bit of a pivot for me professionally. So, you know, what I spend a lot of my time doing now professionally is I still teach in business school, but I don't teach strategy anymore. I teach what I call creative leadership. And what is creative leadership? For me, creative leadership is working out how to thrive, how to perform at a high level in your career, but at the same time, being able to juggle things creatively in a such a way that you don't have to make those same sacrifices that many of us default to or think we have to make. So, yeah, I spend a lot of my time now trying to help people in a way to what I say, I said in my TED talk, you know, to shoot for their own moon, to work out what success and happiness means for them. And that gives me a huge amount of satisfaction right now with what I do professionally.
You actually quoted Lao Tzu, I think, as I remember, about a path. Before we sign off, I'd like you to repeat just that particular quote from him and put it in context for us today.
So in my TED talk, I quote Lao Tzu as a Chinese philosopher. And one of the things that Lao Tzu says is that if you keep heading in the same direction, you're likely to get where you're going. And I think that for me, the meaning in that poem and what I reflected upon myself was that I needed to sit back and actually think about what is the goal. You know, we're on this journey. We have these ambitions. But ultimately, what is the goal? And I think far too few of us really reflect upon that in a wider sense of what is the goal in life. You know, we define our success by a goal in our career or in our, you know, financial income or whatever it might be. And that exercise of sitting down with my wife and reflecting upon success much more broadly completely reframed, you know, how I saw success and how I saw the journey. And once my wife and I had drawn that picture for ourselves and we knew what success meant for us, then it was so much easier to head towards it, because then when any kind of professional opportunity came up, here I'm talking about work opportunities, if it didn't fit with the picture, I would just say no. So yeah, that's very meaningful for us. And, you know, the other thing about it now is that my kids are now in their, you know, my youngest is now 13, my oldest is almost 18, but we still sit down as a family pretty much every November, December time, and we kind of pull that picture out, you know, we pull that piece of paper out and we say, okay, what's the vision for us as a family for the next 18 months, 2 years? You know, what do we want as a family now? And we agree upon that as a collective, and that also is an amazing discussion and experience, because it's all about give and take and it's all about respecting and acknowledging that each of us has our different dreams and aspirations, and then trying to accommodate that as a family. And of course, my cycling is always a part of that.
Well, Jamie, this has just been a delightful conversation, and I knew it would be from the moment I saw who you are and what you do. So how can people find out more about this work that you're doing and maybe get on board with it and reach out to you if they want to?
Sure. And Dan, and honestly, and I do really say this sincerely, you know, I really do make time to speak to people, to connect with people. Certainly the first place to start is my TED talk, because I think that explains a lot about what motivates me and drives me as a person.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, for me, LinkedIn is super important, because it's a very important platform for me professionally. You know, I do a lot of writing. I post video blogs there. I do, and that's a mix of the stuff I do professionally, talking about creative leadership, but also I do a load of stuff on cycling. So I have my own YouTube channel called This Cycling Life. And on that YouTube channel, I really talk about how do you juggle these three balls of career, family, and your sporting passion. So that's another place people can connect. But certainly if people have questions or comments and they want to follow what I'm doing, both in terms of the writing and the vlogging, then LinkedIn is a great platform for that. And you just need to search for Professor Jamie Anderson. There's lots of Jamie Andersons in the world, but if you search for Professor Jamie Anderson on LinkedIn, you should find me there.
And we will put all those links on our Facebook page and our other social media. Well, I hope you keep the rubber side down, that you continue on this amazing path that you're on. And I appreciate you taking time, especially right before the holidays. I think it's a good time to sit down and think about what the next year will bring. Have a wonderful Christmas and New Year, and I hope we get to talk again.
Dan, thank you very much for your time. And of course, keep doing the awesome stuff that you're doing with the podcast. It's great. I'm one of your fans. So absolutely a pleasure to be here, and wishing everyone all the best for the holiday season.
Thank you.
If you are interested in finding out more about Jamie and his work, you can listen to his TED Talk on his YouTube channel, This Cycling Life. You can also connect with Jamie on LinkedIn by searching Professor Jamie Anderson. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with Sean Wilson, founder of the Youth Cycling Association. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Sean Wilson is an associate professor at Loma Linda University and the founder of the Youth Cycling Association. Combining his pro racing career, his work in the medical field, and an abiding interest in getting young children on bikes safely, he's looking to bridge the gap for children to excel in bicycling and to making it a lifelong sport. I'm not certain how he does all that he does, but his passion, intelligence, and abiding interest in cycling makes a great conversation.
Hello, Sean. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week, and happy holidays.
You're welcome, and I'm really glad to be here.
Well, you have a lot going on, so I want to get to it. So much activity. I don't know how you do it all. You're an associate professor of physiology and pharmacology at Loma Linda University School of Medicine. President and founder of the Youth Cycling Association, which is clearly what we're going to talk about, and about a half a dozen other things. So let's stick pretty much with cycling, although our talk before we actually went on air did say that you're going to be sort of combining some of the medical research and teaching that you're doing with cycling, which I think is very, very cool. Let's talk about how you first became interested in riding, racing, and then coaching, and then starting this amazing organization.
Right. So I've been involved in the sport since I've been a junior cyclist. I actually started riding bikes in Davis, California, where I grew up. And it was only natural for me to get involved with the local cycling club, which was the Davis Bike Club. And I'm still a member of their club, even though I don't live in town now. And through getting to learn about the sport from mentors within the Davis Bike Club, they actually pushed me to start racing. And at the time, I didn't realize it, but you know, the person that kind of pushed me in that direction was actually racing at the national level. I mean, she was she'd done national team trips and things like that. And I didn't realize it. I was just doing centuries with her, and she was older than me. You know, I was a young junior, and she was in college, kind of thing. And once I got ingrained with the racing part of the organization, you know, I had a new set of mentors. A lot of them also were college students. And I didn't realize it at the time, but we had David Brink coming out and riding with us, who was part of the Olympic team in Mexico City. And I had no idea. I just thought he was some older guy riding a, you know, kind of a, you know, beat up steel bike with us juniors. And we learned a lot from him, you know, and from the other mentors. And, you know, it turned out that one of my mentors was good friends with Greg LeMond out in Sacramento. And, you know, and I had been coming through the junior ranks, and as a first year senior, I was racing extremely well. And I had opportunities to ride with Greg, and he got me my first pro contract. And from that, I had learned a lot already about the sport, and I just raced at the domestic level. I never went over to Europe to race, but, you know, I was always having fun with it, and I was really learning not just about the passion of the sport, but for myself, I was learning how to be perseverant and really be persistent in terms of maintaining life goals and focus and moving through. On the flip side of all this, I'm actually what I consider a faculty brat. My dad was a professor at Davis, at UC Davis, and from that, you know, I was always expected to go to college and pursue, you know, something in college, right? It, you know, I was never told I had to go into a specific line of study or anything. And I actually got my first two degrees in physical education, exercise, physiology. And so that's a lot of times I try to meld that in with the science that I do, even though it's not completely related to exercise. My research career is based around looking at mechanisms of pulmonary hypertension. And, you know, we do things with high altitude research and looking at the development of the pulmonary vascular system and how it's adapting to high altitude environments due to gestational hypoxia. So this is now actually the baby. So we look at how babies have problems when they're born at high altitude and trying to solve those problems. You know, which requires the same kind of persistence that I gained from cycling. You know, in order to do research, it becomes a grind to work through problems and figure out the puzzles, which is why I do it. I enjoy that learning process.
So interesting. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Sean Wilson. We're talking right now about his academic work, but how it sort of melds with his work in cycling. I do want to talk about the Youth Cycling Association. You are the founder. You are the head of it. How did you become involved in youth cycling as opposed to, let's say, picking it up as junior racers or your – there's something right after between kids and juniors. I thought there was another intermediate category there. And then going on to the higher levels of adult racing. How did you focus on kids? Why?
That's a really good question. And, you know, it really goes back to thinking about what it is about the sport that's so special. And it comes around to, you know, when I first got on a bike, it was that freedom of exploration, you know, associated with just riding bikes. And as my own children grew up, right, so as they grew, I was a parent and we were involved in a variety of different sports. And we always would ride bikes and they enjoyed it. And, you know, I had been a coach. I mean, we didn't really talk about me getting into coaching, but the reason why I became a coach was because I didn't have strong coaching when I was a junior or even as I came up really through the ranks. It was a series of mentors who didn't have any kind of formal education in the process. And as an academic, I could see, you know, once I had my own education under my belt, I could see the large holes in terms of what I had learned coming through the sport. And I always wanted to be able to give that back. And it just goes along with being an academic and being involved in teaching at, you know, the college level. I apply those same techniques when I work with athletes or I work with other coaches in coaching education and things like that. And the youth part of all this comes about from, you know, working with my own kids and seeing that there really wasn't a whole lot of opportunities for children. Most clubs now, well, even when I came through, they really weren't oriented specifically for youth. And so it makes it really difficult for, you know, a young rider to learn what's important for them to be first off, you know, be able to be safe when they ride their bikes and so they can go and enjoy the sport, right? And so that was kind of how I got involved with the youth side of things, you know, with my own kids. And associated with that, you know, it's not fun for a kid to ride by themselves. So we started a club that allowed for our own children to ride with other kids that had similar passion. And it just started off as a cycling club, basically. And then that has grown into a racing operation. And then associated with that, I was still involved with coaching education, which, tied me in with a lot of the other coaches around the nation. And what we found was that there was a lot of holes in terms of what was available to us in terms of, the knowledge base. But I knew that, each of us have our own backgrounds. And when we come together, we can have discussions about, topics that are important for us as a sport. And so the Youth Cycling Association really grew out of those conversations that we've had over the last 5 or 6 years. So it was just moving from informal workshops that I'd been running to talk about specific barriers associated with the sport and potential solutions to now making it a formal operation where we can come together as coaches and make a consensus style of decision-making for what activities we're going to do and what things we'll push forward on.
If this is located right now for you where you are, are these other coaches in surrounding areas? Do they go across the country?
Yeah. So, I would say, we're a national consortium, and in fact, we have coaches that are international too that work with us because we all have our own networks, right? And so we use those networks to our advantage for learning new information and bringing new ideas to the table and then being able to help our sport move forward in our country, right? I mean, that's our goal, is to really help kids in our own country, but we're going to try to use tools that are available anywhere, right, from any source, and do it in a positive way.
How old do these kids have to be to actually start in your program? I mean, do they have to be already riding? Do they need to have a bike?
Again, I want to delineate, that on the one side, I'm running a junior development program here located in Redlands where I live. And in that program, what we've actually done is we've built that out with the specific idea that we want to overcome a lot of the barriers to the sport. And the first thing we did is we decided that we would have bicycles in hand. And so we have a large fleet of bicycles, probably over 100 bikes now, that range from 20-inch wheeled road bikes up to 63-centimeter bikes. Basically, any kid can come in. Ideally, they would have their own bike, but if they don't, we just fit them to a bike and off they go, basically, and we incorporate them into our activity.
Where'd you get them? Where did these come from?
So a lot of them are donated. We've donated our own personal bikes, and then I have a family foundation, and so we purchase bikes through that means. And we've developed partnerships with certain manufacturers. We work with Frog Bikes pretty closely, which makes very small bicycles, which are perfect for these younger kids. They're very well designed, and they're out of the UK, right? They're not a US manufacturer. A lot of the stuff is donated, and so we really rely on our community to help us with what we're trying to accomplish.
How many kids are in the program right now?
Yeah, so we have about 50 kids in our program, and it's been relatively stable for a number of years. And this is where, some of the things, from an academic point of view, I use the junior project as a test bed for new ideas. And so one of the things that I've really noticed is that we aren't getting huge influxes of kids, right? We're getting just small numbers at any one time. And, we have kids rotating in and out constantly. So it seems to be a fairly stable number of kids. And so we have, discussions both locally and then with our national our organization through, our network to be able to say, okay, what other tools can we use to try to improve and get more kids riding bikes and engaged with our activities. And so that's where, using that network, we're trying to work through some of those issues and trying to think of new ways to recruit riders into the programs.
Are you focusing on things like skills as well as safety? And are you offering kids a way to begin actually racing their bikes? Or are you just hoping that they become lifelong cyclists?
The goal is to build lifelong cyclists. And part of our mission statement is really building life skills through cycling, right? So you could even look at it that it's similar to like a karate dojo, right? Those are the same kinds of things that they do. And in our case, we do push them to do what they want to do in the sport. And a lot of times that does entail going into racing. But, you know, when we look at these little kids coming in, right, our first goal is to get them riding safely. And so we start on playgrounds, doing playground skills, drills, things of that nature. We try to keep it as fun as possible. And then we get them up to the point where we can get them out on the street. And at that point, you know, we want them to be able to ride in a group effectively and safely, right? Because group rides are nice and social, and we want them to enjoy riding with their friends and being able to do it in a safe, effective manner. And then simultaneous with that, because, you know, we're out on the road for a lot of our activities, as we teach them cycling safety. So we partner a lot of times with the League of American Bicyclists to bring in LCIs to teach. When we've also partnered a lot with Cycling Savvy, so we bring in their instructors to teach. And, you know, and again, you know, from my academic experience and from coaching, is that it's always good to have a variety of different viewpoints. So we bring in different coaches that have different viewpoints that can teach the kids in a little bit different ways. And so that they'll hopefully respond better to one mode of learning versus another.
Let me reintroduce you one more time. We're speaking with Sean Wilson. He has founded the Youth Cycling Association. He's out in California, but the association is spreading its wings all across the U.S. to bring young kids into the sport in a, what I would call a...
We use a process to bring kids into the sport. The local project that I run, we're GS Andiamo Junior Cycling. We are a center of excellence with USA Cycling. And so, you know, we work very closely with USA Cycling for our activities within the club. But then through the larger association, the coaching network, when we come up with new ideas, if they fit what our needs are in our local community, I will test bed those ideas and see if they work. You know, a lot of clubs are, I don't want to say that they're stuck, but they have a process of doing things that's very rigorous, right, or systematic. And I'm not afraid to just add something new in, right? You know, keeping it fresh and trying new things is, I think, important for us as a sport to be able to move forward into the future. We can't just rely on old methods of doing things, because clearly there's better ways. There's a lot of science out there about new techniques and training, new techniques and working with groups, especially young people in terms of the long-term development models and things like that, which aren't fully fleshed out yet. And there's a lot of work to be done. And I'm using our local organization, you know, our local club, to test those ideas and see which ones work best for us. And which ones we can recommend to others through the coaching network right across the country.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Sean some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we are speaking with Sean Wilson. He founded Youth Cycling Association. So that's so interesting. There's been, as you well know, which is how I discovered your organization and you, it was through the conversation, the discussion that's been going on about USA Cycling's new Olympic Development Academy. So what I'm hearing and what I'm hoping I'm hearing is that there is this sort of groundswell of activity and interest and forward thinking in getting more young kids into cycling and keeping them there and letting them develop into whatever kind of cyclists they're going to be, but to stay with two wheels.
Yes, exactly. And there is a lot of forward motion in those areas. And as you've noticed, there is a lot of active discussion and there's a lot of controversy. you know, regarding what is the best path, right? And in one way to look at it, you know, in the way that USA Cycling has looked at it, you know, is you have to sometimes move in new directions in order to break free of the limitations that you've had in the past, right? And so this new development academy is part of that process. You know, it's one element along a developmental pathway, right? So you can see that the athletes that are entering this, I think when you interviewed Rob, you know, he was mentioning that it starts at age 16, right? And I'm talking about starting with kids that are ages, you know, 5 and 6.
Right.
And there's a huge, you know, there's a huge timeline between that, right? And you have to be able to provide programming along that entire timeline. And you know, that's where, you know, the Youth Cycling Association really comes into play, is that, you know, as a group, we can say, hey, you know, what does that timeline really look like? And what kind of activities do there need to be in place for those kids, you know, just so that they enjoy the sport, and then, you know, providing them the opportunities that you would want them to have so that they can move into whatever aspect of the sport they enjoy. You know, clearly USA Cycling and its mission is really focused on developing Olympic athletes and professional riders and things of that nature. And they're, you know, through Rob's direction and also through his predecessor, Derek Bouchard Hall, you know, they've made this kind of pivot to include recreational riding and other types of things, right? And there's going to be bumps along the road because they are trying to take, you know, move into other areas of the sport that they don't naturally align with. And they're trying to generate the partnerships, you know, with things like People for Bikes, you know, and they work with the Bicycle League a little bit. You know, they're having discussions with NYCA and things of that nature, which is really important, and it's going to be very beneficial in the long run. But in the short run, it's bumpy,
right.
And there's no way around it.
So the last thing I want to talk about is how you'll be able to expand the YCA, the Youth Cycling Association, financially, and then staffing up. So we know that there are a finite number of people who are professionally coaching, meaning they have some training in cycle coaching. What about a coaching program that you would be able to roll out to, like, neighborhood groups? And how are you financing the YCA to get it to expand?
Right. So, I mean, we'll talk about the financing first. So from a financial standpoint, at the present time, it's my family foundation that's funding the YCA project. While we look like we can be a large organization, and we can be, you've already kind of touched on some of the areas that we've discussed moving into, is that we are an amalgamation of all of the coaches around the nation and the clubs and those with vested interest who want to engage with us, right? I mean, we're not forceful in that regard, right? We want people to come to us and look at us as a resource point. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Because of that, we don't have a lot of expenses, right? Everybody's volunteering their time to push forward ideas that are important to them. So, you know, that's where, as a consortium, you know, we can basically sit down around the table and say, okay, here's 5 or 6 different ideas. Who's interested in them? And then you find the ones that people are most interested in, and those become the things that we push forward on. So we've talked about, you know, developing coaching curricula. And, you know, through that discussion, it was like, okay, let's think about that a little bit more, because we know that that's a large task. You know, I've ran some of the numbers over the years about what it would take me to sit down and develop that curriculum. You know, as an academic, I do these things as my day job, to develop classes and developing lectures and things like that. It's a multi-year with many, many hours of work and rework to do it properly. And so then it's like, okay, you know, that's not something that as an organization that we can do on our own at this point, because we need like $500,000 or something like that.
Right.
Is my rough estimate. And so that becomes more of a governing body type thing to do, but they have to want to do it. They have to decide that this is important, and this is something that we'll do, right? So the initiatives that we have moving forward right now are a little bit more on the think tank side on one part, and which is you know, just coming up, we're actually going to have a, we're calling it the American Cycling Development Workshop Series. And it's something that we've been kicking around for a couple of years. You know, is the idea of being able to talk about long-term development models, and there's some good ones out there in Canada. There's another one that just rolled out for Holland, for Cycling Holland. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to have a leading expert, Dr. Kristen Dieffenbach. She's going to come on next week and present to the group about long-term development. She's presented this in a variety of different contexts over the last year. And so we're just going to do it as a kickoff conversation starter, where we're actually going to do a discussion about long-term development in the United States and talk about what our strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities are associated with that process. And so we'll just try to generate a landscape for what things look like right now. And then from that, we can decide, you know, here's some holes that we need to fill. And then do we try to fill them on our own, or do we go back to like USA Cycling or NYCA or whoever and basically say, hey, you know, we see this as an opportunity. We think that you should fill this hole.
So the last thing is, of course, tell my listeners how they can find out more about your work, about if they have kids or grandkids and want to get involved in their community, how they could hook up with a group and or start a group.
Right. These are big issues, right? And
they are.
Those are really, really cool things to do, right? Is the, you know, getting a kid on a bike is really healthy. It's really fun. It's a great family activity to do. The question that you bring up is how to do that through your local community, right? And the reality is that a lot of communities have bicycle clubs, but a lot of those clubs do not really support youth riders, which
right.
is very unfortunate. And so then it really falls on the parent to start doing something. And I've seen this in a variety of clubs. And that's where the Youth Cycling Association can be of assistance, because we do have a very strong network of very large youth-based organizations that we can draw from. And one of the key ones that we have is actually another, I call it a sister organization called Juniors Matter. And what they've done is they actually generate a national network of clubs. So it's actually directly listed on their website. So if you have a kid that's interested in riding bikes, or as a family you're interested in riding bikes, you can actually go to their website, and they have like a national map, and you can click on your state and find a club directly that's near you, right? And if they're isn't one that's listed there, you know, you can go to the national databases through like the League of American Bicyclists, or, you know, you just even looking on your hometown to see if there is a bicycle club that you can work with. And if there is no youth operation there, that's when you can come back to the Youth Cycling Association and help provide materials that can help you navigate that process, working with a club to be able to start a junior section or youth section to that club. And then if you wanted to start something on your own, certainly we can provide information that can get you started on that. And I know that USA Cycling is actually developing a toolkit right now, and we've provided information for them as well as some of our other partner clubs through the Youth Cycling Association. And so I'm looking forward to seeing those materials roll out here sometime early 2021.
Well, Juniors Matter is an excellent website, and I just clicked on it just to see what was here in Ohio, and the closest club to where I am, I'm in the northeast corner of Ohio, is down in Dayton. But I think that if you're involved in it in one area, you could probably find some help in getting it started in another area. There's something in most states, I guess they're saying 39 states. That's pretty good so far. Well, Sean, this has just been such an interesting conversation. I am abidingly interested in getting more kids on bikes and keeping them there, as opposed to having them turn 16 and handing them a set of car keys. And to get them to be skillful and safe and to stay interested in all of the healthy benefits, and, you know, mind, body, spirit, it just makes me really, really happy to know that somebody like you is out there doing this work. So I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I look forward to working with you in the future. We need people like yourself that are active in the community, but come with different vantage points, right? You come in as more of a journalist rather than just a coach, right? So you bring a different part of that equation, and that's an part of the equation that we need is these varied viewpoints in order for us to really move our work forward.
Well, I appreciate that, and I will stay in touch, and we will post everything on our social media, and have a wonderful holiday, a happy new year. Stay safe, stay well. Are you in line for a vaccine anytime soon?
Yes, through working in the medical school, we are, you know, all the faculty members are part of Tier 1, so we will be getting
excellent.
We will be getting our vaccinated.
Well, again, have a happy new year. Thank you again for talking with me, and we will talk again.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on.
All righty. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
If you are interested in learning more about Youth Cycling Association, you can log on to ycacycling.com. My thanks to Sean and Jamie Anderson for joining me on the show this week. I really enjoyed both conversations, and I hope you did too. I also hope that you're having a great holiday week. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page and leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, where you will also find all of the previous episodes. Please consider subscribing to the podcast if you don't already and leaving a review on your favorite podcast app. Next week, we'll be back with a brand new show and a new feature to start your year off right. Thank you so much for listening. May you have a peaceful, safe, and healthy new year. And while we can't get out here to ride in Northeast Ohio, if you can, I sure hope you will. Bye-bye. If you are interested in learning more about Youth Cycling Association, you can log on to ycacycling.com. My thanks to Sean and Jamie Anderson for joining me on the show this week. I really enjoyed both conversations, and I hope you did too. I also hope that you're having a great holiday week. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page and leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, where you will also find all of the previous episodes. Please consider subscribing to the podcast if you don't already and leaving a review on your favorite podcast app. Next week, we'll be back with a brand new show and a new feature to start your year off right. Thank you so much for listening. May you have a peaceful, safe, and healthy new year. And while we can't get out here to ride in Northeast Ohio, if you can, I sure hope you will. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.